The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Craig H.D. Armon presiding.
Morning, counsel. Next case we'll call is 4-21-0544. People of the State of Illinois versus Matthew A. Anderson. Could counsel for the appellant please state your name for the record?
Good morning. I'm Daryl Oman, and I represent the appellant, Matthew Anderson.
Thank you. And counsel for the appellee, could you please state your name for the record?
My name is Kim Nofke, and I represent the people of the State of Illinois.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Oman, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Again, I am Daryl Oman, and I represent the appellant, Matthew Anderson, in this case. I raised two issues in my brief. First, that the evidence was insufficient to prove that Mr. Anderson personally shot and killed Curtis Hairston, approximately causing his death during a shootout in the bathroom of Long John Silver's in Decatur. And the second issue is that the lead detective's testimony contains improper hearsay and narration of a surveillance video that was admitted at the trial in this case. With respect to the first issue, I'll briefly highlight not the evidence used to convict Mr. Anderson, because there is very little of that. Rather, I'll highlight the lack of evidence that Mr. Anderson personally fired the shot that approximately caused Mr. Harrison's death, which was the burden that the state accepted when it decided to obtain the 25 to life add-on to the first degree murder conviction in this case. The surveillance video only shows the outside of the bathroom. The only person in the video identified by trial witnesses is Mr. Hairston, who had collapsed outside of the bathroom and identified himself to responding EMTs.
Counsel, before you proceed, when you say the video only shows the outside of the bathroom, but there were other cameras in the restaurant, one of which was a camera that was in the front part of the restaurant and which did clearly depict the defendant as he entered the restaurant. Is that right?
Two parts to that answer. First, there are, in fact, multiple camera angles. That's correct. My point about not depicting the inside of the bathroom is, of course, for obvious reasons, none of the camera angles show the inside of the bathroom where the shootout took place. I absolutely do not agree with Your Honor's second point that it clearly shows the defendant, nor was the case tried in that manner. The videos are kind of mid-tier quality. They do show four black men. And I want to be clear, the reason that I've argued the case in my briefs the way that I have, explaining the four men and distinguishing them based on their outerwear, is so that when Your Honor's reviewed the video, which I'm sure some or all of you already have, you know exactly, precisely who I'm talking about when I talk about Curtis Hairston, who we know, because he collapsed at the scene, is a man wearing a gray hoodie in the video. There's also a man in a red hoodie, a man in a black and white jacket, and a man in a white kind of puffy jacket. It has a hood, not clear whether it's attached or underneath.
Yeah, counsel, you know, throughout this argument, we'll probably agree to disagree in regards to your characterization, because I did review the video that you referred to, the multiple angles. To me, the video itself appeared to be clear. The colors appeared to be true, and would appear to me that your client is recognizable in the video, and the hood that he is seen wearing is gray in color.
We, of course, will agree to disagree, but that's not conclusive, because even if all of Your Honors agree that he's clearly depicted in the video, I'll return to the actual burden facing the state is not to prove that he was inside the Long John Silver's that day or that he entered the bathroom. The burden on the state, in addition to the requirements of proving first-degree murder, is to prove that he's the person who fired the shots that proximately caused the death of the decedent, Curtis Hairston. And there's certainly no evidence of that, regardless of how you feel about the video, which returns to my earlier point, that there's not video of the inside of the bathroom where the shootout took place. So even if Your Honor feels that the video shows Mr. Anderson being present along John Silver, entering the bathroom, fleeing the Long John Silver's, that doesn't prove that he shot anyone, doesn't even prove that he had a gun on that day. The state's burden in this case was much higher than that. And the video is not remotely sufficient proof to prove that burden beyond a reasonable doubt.
And I'm sure you'll get to this and talk about Mr. Sisley, but an eyewitness who identified a man with a gray hooded sweatshirt with a gun. And that would be consistent with defendant, correct?
Again, I'm sure Your Honor, as Your Honor mentioned, will agree to disagree on this, but your mention of a gray hooded sweatshirt clearly describes the decedent. It's beyond clear that, again, assuming for the sake of argument, Matthew Anderson's depicted in the video, he's wearing a white coat, and it may have a gray hood, but the coat itself is white. The coat was admitted into evidence and contained in the exhibits presented to this court. And in fact, Detective Nyrum testified that he was wearing a, quote, white North Face down-filled jacket. And on cross-examination, he clarified that it was, quote, a white jacket, close quote, and not a gray hoodie. Again, it may have had a gray hood. I'm not trying to be deceptive here. It shows what it shows. But I think it's beyond dispute that it was a white North Face down-filled jacket. There's even testimony from the detectives who came to collect evidence at the scene that there was some sort of downy material protruding from the jacket. So I think we're all familiar with this sort of a coat, and it can be distinguished in plain terms from what we're also very familiar with, which is a gray hoodie. It's a very, very common form of male dress, I think, throughout the state. Your Honor mentioned the testimony of George Sisley, which he was the only eyewitness to testify at trial, but yet he did not testify and make an identification of my client. In fact, officers took him to the hospital to identify Mr. Anderson, and he made, quote, a negative identification that appears in the transcripts on pages 387 to 88. Mr. Sisley was present in the courtroom during the trial with my client sitting at the defense table. He did not make an in-court identification of my client as the person in the gray hoodie firing the shots.
Was he asked specifically to make an in-court identification?
He was not, and that's because the state knew that he had not made a previous identification. In fact, it would be improper for him to make an identification at trial if that information had not been tendered to the defense previously. But not only did he fail to make an identification, the record shows that he made a negative identification. All of his testimony about the man in the gray hoodie was not about my client. So regardless of how we view the videos, subjectively or agree to disagree, we can't disagree about what Mr. Sisley testified to. He testified about a man firing into the bathroom. And again, as Your Honors are going through the video, I'd ask you to focus on the sequence of events in the order with which people left the bathroom. First, the man in the red hoodie. Second, the man in the white jacket, who we're assuming for the purpose of this argument is my client. Then the man in the gray hoodie, decedent Curtis Harrison, who Mr. Sisley testified the man in the gray hoodie was firing into the bathroom. Referencing again the camera angles available and the record in this case, Mr. Sisley was standing towards the front of the restaurant and looked back towards the back into the bathroom. He had a very different point of view than I would say the most salient camera angle from the surveillance video, which is side on to the door of the bathroom. Mr. Sisley was looking at it this way from the front of the restaurant. He was able to see into the bathroom, was ever able to see the man in the gray hoodie firing. Again, this is the second volley of shots. Again, to be clear, there were two volleys of shots. First volley, the man in the red hoodie almost knocked over Mr. Sisley and his wife leaving the restaurant. The sequence of events shows that the man in the white jacket was right behind him. And at this point, the only two people left in the bathroom were the man in the hoodie, gray hoodie, Curtis Harrison, and the man in the black and white jacket. So according to Mr. Sisley's testimony, the man in the gray hoodie was firing a handgun in the bathroom. The only person in the bathroom at that point, in addition to Mr. Harrison, is the man in the black and white jacket. And we have no properly admitted information who this person is. The state's argument simply assumes he was with Mr. Harrison, but it presented no evidence to that effect. And the evidence shown from the surveillance video, as I've argued, tends to indicate the opposite. And again, emphasizing the actual precise burden facing the state, it's very significant that the state introduced no evidence that my client possessed or fired a handgun. The murder weapon in this case, according to the pathologist and the firearms examiner, was a .44 caliber firearm, presumably a handgun. So we're talking about something like a .44 revolver. This would have been easily seen. It's not analogous to what's shown on the video. The state's going to contend that he's shown pulling this .44 handgun out of his pocket when their own lead detective in this case, Detective Nyrum, testified that you cannot tell based on the video whether it's a handgun, and it can, in fact, be just a cell phone, and that appears in, during his testimony at pages 608 to 611 of the report of proceedings.
What do you make of the jail phone conversation that was recorded where your client is asking somebody to try to find a cell phone cover that looks like a revolver. That's a question to you.
Oh, sorry. Yes, during the conversations, a lot of which is really unintelligible, what is clear is he is discussing his defense strategy and what he had discussed with his defense attorney and what sort of evidence he might present that might be incriminating. I think he anticipated this argument that the state is making on appeal, that they're going to say that this is a gun he's pulling out of his jacket. Of course, this is before Detective Nyrum, the lead detective in this case, testified that you can't tell. And again, Your Honors, based on your own review, could tell that a small black rectangular object is not consistent with essentially the equivalent, if not exactly, a 44 Magnum revolver. Again, there's no 44 caliber shell cases recovered at the scene. So I think the physical evidence tends to indicate the murder weapon was a 44 revolver and not some tiny black 22 semi-automatic or something that even arguably could be consistent with a small black rectangular object. With respect to the second issue, I'd like to focus on primarily the way that the officer improperly narrated the surveillance video and told the jury that one of the men, quote, is later identified, close quote, as Mr. Anderson, which appears on page 581 of the report of proceedings. The rule announced by the Illinois Supreme Court in Thompson indicates that this sort of testimony is improper because the officer was in no better position to testify about what was appearing on the video. And as Your Honor pointed out, the justices of this court themselves could evaluate the video themselves. He's not providing any helpful testimony by saying who is in the video and who's doing it. And in fact, the only basis for that testimony is inadmissible hearsay. Second, Thompson also provides that even where such evidence is properly admitted, it must be preceded by an instruction telling the jury how to interpret such evidence, and that these instructions must be given a second time at the conclusion of the evidence along with the other jury instructions. That did not happen in this case. So Thompson provides two independent reasons why, assuming for the sake of argument, this court does not agree to reverse outright, it should at least, at the very least, remand for a new trial in light of this improper testimony and the other improper hearsay argued in my briefs. The state's only response to this is to offer a single case, People versus Mister, which is very, very clearly distinguishable both on its facts and the legal issue presented. Mister, first of all, is not even an identification case. The witness who testified concerning the surveillance video in that case did not identify the defendant as appearing in the video. Second, it does talk about narrating the surveillance video, so it is at least somewhat on point in this case, but the facts are markedly different in that this was a casino supervisor talking about 5 hours of footage gleaned from numerous video cameras across the entire casino complex. And this court very reasonably concluded that it would be a waste of the jury's resources and the court's resources to pore over that video in an attempt to try to figure out what's happening, that it should avail itself and would be helpful to the jury, which is the standard rule here, for the casino supervisor to testify in this manner. That's very, very different than the relatively short clips in this case, which Your Honors have already reviewed. It surely would not be a waste of time for the jury to pore over that evidence, which is the most salient evidence in this case. So for all of these reasons and the additional reasons in my brief, this court should reverse his conviction, and if it's not willing to go that far, at least remand for a new trial without improper hearsay and narration testimony. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You'll have an opportunity in rebuttal. Mr. Nofke, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. I think the evidence in this case is consistent with a pre-planned hit on Hairston, and it supports the inference that defendant was the hitman that shot and killed Hairston. I noticed that the defendant's brief, he raises three reasonable doubt arguments, basically. One, there was no evidence the defendant was even there. There was no evidence that defendant participated in the shootout. And there was no evidence, principally, that that defendant actually shot Hairston. I'd like to address each one of those. The defendant was there. We have the fact that he showed up at the hospital shortly after the shootout with a gunshot wound in a correlative, wearing the gray hoodie with a defect in the hoodie that would be consistent with him having been shot. To me, that's very salient evidence the defendant was in fact there. In addition, while the defendant was in custody, and this has already been a reference, he spoke to people on the outside and basically acknowledged that he was present while encouraging the person to whom he was speaking to look for photos of a cell phone that would resemble the handle of a gun. And third, a detective near him identified defendant on the video. As far as defendant participating in the shooting, we have the video itself, which shows defendant coming into the restaurant, sitting in a booth outside the restroom, seemingly waiting for something. At the precise moment that the man in the red hoodie comes out of the restroom, defendant gets up, passes that individual. Simultaneously, you see defendant lean into the restroom, appearing his arms are not at his side. This is after he's pulled out whatever it was he had in his pocket, which is pretty clearly it was a gun. He extends his hands in front of him, and then you see a puff of smoke. After that puff of smoke, you see defendant exit, come back because he's apparently dropped something, which I would suggest is probably a gun or shell casings, pick them up and run off. The other individual, defendant wants to suggest that the other individual, the man in the black and white coat, might have been involved in this shooting, but clearly he was aligned with Mr. Harrison. He was with Mr. Harrison before the man in the red hoodie showed up. When the man in the black and white coat came out after the shooting, he appears to check on the condition of Harrison, and then seemingly very concerned about his safety, that the man in the white coat, black and white coat safety, he cautiously goes out of the restaurant. There's nothing to indicate that he was involved in the shooting or that he was anything other than aligned with Harrison. And then we have the two people that were shot in the shootout. It was an exchange of gunfire, obviously, between defendant and Harrison. Those are the only two people that were shot. So it seems clear that that defendant was a participant in the shooting.
Counsel, can I ask a question about the man and the or the individual in the red sweatshirt, and then the individual you've identified as defendant wearing the gray hoodie? The video which shows the man in the red sweatshirt coming out of the restroom and defendant at the same time entering, it almost looked timed or coordinated. Was there a theory presented at trial by the state as that the two were acting in a coordinated fashion, or what was the theory there?
I actually don't recall a theory presented to that effect. I mean, I do not recall that. But from the timing of their actions, it seems to me that it would have had to have been a coordinated thing. You see defendant at the moment that the man in the red hoodie comes out of the restroom, you see defendant jump up and charge into the restroom. You know, I'm trying to think of reasons why the defendant would do that if there was no coordination. An urgent need to use the restroom seems unlikely. An urgent need to take a picture of someone in the restroom with a camera seems unlikely. I mean, it seems the only reasonable inference is that this was coordination between these two individuals, and they were setting up Harrison to be shot and killed.
Because the evidence was that this was a deal that was going down in the restroom involving an exchange of handguns.
Right. Okay. That's correct. But I don't think a theory was actually presented, at least not that I recall, that to the effect of that there was a coordination or planned coordination.
The circumstances Mr. Roman, pointed out the obvious problem with Mr. Sisley not being able to identify defendant in the photograph. How was that handled by the state during closing argument? Do you remember?
I'm sorry, I don't specifically recall how the state handled that either. I think that obviously it's a very emotional situation where, you know, an individual sees someone start firing. They're, from that point on, I mean, they're concerned for their own safety. So, but no, I don't recall how the state handled that particular matter.
Okay, thank you.
And the third question here is whether defendant actually shot, whether defendant actually shot Hairston, which, you know, supports the add-on. We have, again, two people shot in the restroom. There are two people shot during the exchange of gunfire. The weapons that were found in the restroom, none of those fired the shots that killed the Hairston. And I have to say that it seems clear that Hairston was aligned with the man in the black and white jacket. So he was not the instrument of Hairston's death. And I guess it also seems clear to me, I assume clear also to the jury, the defendant's actions in charging at the restroom and firing were aggressive, pre-planned, and that alone would support the inference that he shot Hairston. I'd like to address the question of Detective Neerham's identification of a defendant on the video, since that was also addressed. I'd point out first that defense counsel invited any error because defense counsel said, I don't have any problem with the detective identifying the defendant on the video. So first of all, the error was, if there was an error, which I submit there was not, it was invited. Beyond that, defendant forfeited the issue by failing to properly preserve it. And beyond that, I would say that the testimony was proper under this court's decision in Mister. After the Supreme Court decided Thompson, this court decided Mister. In that case, in Mister at paragraph 71, this court talks about, as it relates to an identification from a surveillance recording, the court, referring to Thompson, found such testimony helpful where, quote, there is some basis for concluding the witness is more likely to correctly identify the defendant from the surveillance recording than the jury. In this case, there was a reason to believe that the detective would be more likely to identify defendant because during the pretrial period when it was discussed whether this testimony would be allowed, it was pointed out that the defendant or that a detective was familiar with the defendant from previous encounters. It was that the defense counsel was trying to keep out of the trial, any mention of that. But that very familiarity supports the identification of the defendant in the video by the detective. Although not required, a sustained contact, intimate familiarity, or special knowledge of the defendant would support the admission of this kind of testimony. Now, counsel has mentioned that the Supreme Court in Thompson did mention an instruction that could be given in this regard. I think the language from Thompson is that an instruction should be given. I would acknowledge that I think the appellate court first district's decision in Stitt, the appellate court characterized that as a mandatory requirement. In Mister, in which was post Thompson, this court didn't require any such instruction, didn't even mention it, even though there was no such instruction given, and nevertheless found this testimony proper. So my position is at least that this court's authority shows that there is no, that instruction is not required. Also, given the evidence in this case, given that it's overwhelming, I don't think there would be any prejudice from failure to give such an instruction. Unless the court has any other questions, I think I'd stand on what's in our brief, and I'd ask the defendant's conviction be affirmed.
I see no questions. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ullman, rebuttal.
May it please the court, I have only two fairly brief points on rebuttal. With respect to my first argument, opposing counsel argued that there was evidence of a pre-planned hit. Again, to be specific, this evidence came from the decedent's cell phone. He had a chat conversation with another individual who wasn't Mr. Anderson, indicating that he was in the process of setting up a gun deal in the bathroom of a Long John Silver's. The fact that Mr. Anderson is not mentioned in the chat and that the chat was with a different person proves that that person had a motive, if the state's correct, if this was a gun deal gone wrong, or a planned set up hit. That person set up the hit, that person executed the hit. The state repeatedly argued that because Mr. Anderson was shot, that's evidence that he in fact was a shooter. This court knows that it just defies common sense. There are ample instances of innocent bystanders getting shot because it's well known that bullets do not have names on them. There's a shootout in a small bathroom. Anyone could have been shot, bullets could ricochet, any number of things could have happened. The mere fact that he was received a handgun injury is not remotely sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he personally shot and killed the decedent, approximately causing his death.
Counsel, let me interject and ask a question, because essentially your position is there was not sufficient evidence showing that your client was present, possessed the firearm, discharged the firearm. Those are the three big issues. But I want you to address sort of the elephant in the room with regard to the totality of the circumstances. You know, just a couple of quick things. Defendant, the chat information, the jail conversation, the showing up the hospital at the same time, similar identifications with the gunshot wound. What are we to do with that? You can parse out all these different arguments and beat them up piecemeal, but taking this totality of the circumstances, how do you deal with that?
I believe it would be perfectly reasonable for this court to conclude, based on the totality of the circumstances, that my client may have been present at Long John Silver's, may have been in the bathroom, possibly aligned with someone in the bathroom. What I'm parsing out is not the evidence. I'm parsing out the elements of the offense, because that has a significant impact on my client, who's serving a 50-year sentence, fully half of which comes from an element that the state chose to allege and instruct the jury that he personally fired the shot that approximately caused the decedent's death. So the totality of the circumstances is a correct approach, but this court also needs to look at the specific elements of this case. Now, while I understand you're reticent to reverse on direct appeals in generally, the Illinois Supreme Court decision in People versus Smith says that it's appropriate to reverse in cases like this one, where the state's key eyewitness is not a very good one. Again, Mr. Sicily does not identify my client, in fact, makes a negative identification. And there's a lack of other corroborating evidence. For example, and to prove that he fired a handgun or fired the handgun that approximately caused deaths, we see that in a myriad of other cases where there's fingerprint evidence, ballistic evidence connected to the defendant, DNA evidence. If he was shot on the scene, he bled on the scene. There was blood in the bathroom. You could have collected the DNA from the blood and matched it to the defendant. GSR, he was wearing a white puffy coat. If he had fired a .44 caliber handgun, there would have been gunshot residue all over his sleeve. It was never even submitted for analysis. So I would say the evidence was extremely lacking with respect to that mandatory element, which results in half of my client's sentence. And again, quickly with respect to the second issue, the error in this case was not invited. The portion of the transcript pointed to by the state discusses the defendant's second motion in limine, which is just a generic bad acts, other crimes motion that's totally typical in criminal cases. What he was trying to put out, and again, the state concedes in its brief on page 10 that the officer's identification of the defendant in the video was not the focus of the motion. He's just trying to prevent proactively the officer from testifying that he had prior contacts with the defendant in other criminal cases, which, to the state's credit, they know that that's improper, and the trial of the prosecutor conceded the issue, did not object to the motion. It was granted without objection. So the sort of thing that was conceded certainly was not an open invitation to say, identify everyone in the video, introduce any manner of hearsay testimony, and certainly not inviting the court not to instruct the jury as reported by Thompson and Stitz, as the state has just acknowledged.
Well, defense counsel said, you know, he, quote, did not have any problem with an officer, with the officer saying, I know who he is, he being a defendant. So I'm not able to reconcile what you just said with that quote.
I mean, that's correct. That's basically the ultimate conclusion in any sort of motion in limine of this nature. The officer is allowed to say, I know who he is. He's not allowed to say why, because that would be a bad acts and other crimes, which is inadmissible. What he wasn't allowed to say is he was later identified as Mr. Anderson. He was later identified as another person in the video. And in fact, he identified four people in the video, at least purported to. There's no basis for the identifications other than information that he was given as the lead investigator in the case. That's hearsay. That's improper. It's not admissible as course of conduct. It's not admissible under Rule 701. It's not admissible under People versus Mister. And it wasn't invited by this mere reference to a motion in limine trying to prevent other bad acts. Therefore, this court should, at the very least, reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement. The court stands in recess.